This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, the surprise results that indicate Australian governments should change their approach to opioid abuse and focus on suicide prevention. And the Packers, the story of the dynasty that's dominated Australian business life for the best part of a century, brought to the stage.
This story, Packer and Sons, has always had the focus of fathers and sons and those moments of transition where the prince tries to take the crown.
But first today to the allegations against Australian banking giant Westpac. The financial intelligence agency AUSTRAC is accusing Westpac of breaching money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws on 23 million occasions. The agency says this exposes the bank to child exploitation rings in Southeast Asia and to massive fines. The Commonwealth Bank was hit with a $700 million fine last year over similar money laundering breaches. With more, I'm joined now by the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. Peter, take us through what AUSTRAC is alleging that Westpac has done.
Well, Eleanor, banks are required under law to report individual transactions of more than $10,000, also for much smaller transactions that go overseas. Now, AUSTRAC is alleging that Westpac failed to report 19.5 million international funds transactions in and out of Australia over the past 5 years. AUSTRAC alleges this amounts to more than $11 billion in transactions that should have been reported between November 2013 and September 2018. Each contravention attracts a maximum civil penalty between $17 million and $21 million. Now, if you add that up on paper with your old primary school mathematics, this would look like $270 billion. But of course, a much smaller penalty in the hundreds of millions of dollars is more likely and, of course, realistic. Most critically for Westpac's reputation, AUSTRAC alleges that by taking its eye off the ball, Westpac exposed itself to child exploitation rings in the Philippines and Southeast Asia. AUSTRAC's chief executive, Nicole Rose, made a brief statement in Canberra this morning and referred to serious and systemic issues that put Westpac in line to child exploitation risks.
Westpac failed to pass on information about the origin of international funds transfers and keep records as required by law. And Westpac failed to carry out appropriate customer due diligence on high-risk transactions to the Philippines and Southeast Asia concerning known financial indicators relating to potential child exploitation risks. This is an important reminder to all financial services businesses in Australia to be vigilant to money laundering and terrorism financing risks and understand their obligations.
So that's AUSTRAC Chief Executive Nicole Rose. Peter, last year the Banking Royal Commission had put pressure on banks and their reputations. Just how damaging is this for Westpac, not just financially, but in terms of this link to these child exploitation rings?
Well, politically, it's also huge given that banks are carpeted all the time. But this morning, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was being very careful with his words, given that the matter is now before the federal court. But after the events, as you mentioned, leading to last year's Royal Commission, including the Commonwealth Bank money laundering scandal, Mr. Morrison appeared to be stunned at the Westpac allegations.
I'm appalled. I'm absolutely appalled. But what it also shows is two things. The banks need to keep lifting their game, but it also shows that our cop on the beat, AUSTRAC, is doing their job. Just as it was with the CommBank, just as been again with Westpac. And, they've just got to lift their game on this stuff. But it is a fairly damning indictment about some of the processes and procedures they've had in place.
And Peter, how is Westpac reacting to these accusations?
Well, Westpac says that it itself reported these allegations and noted the AUSTRAC investigation in its most recent annual report, where it said there could be a significant financial penalty. The big question now is just how systemic these breaches are. And Gavin Durbin, a former AUSTRAC executive, now executive director at the consultancy AML Solutions, says the problem could be right across all the banks.
I think fairly normal. I think a lot of banks, if they took a look at themselves, would probably have very similar issues, to be quite honest.
So you think that this is not just isolated to Westpac or earlier CBA, but this could be systemic in other banks?
Yes, I do. Certainly within Australia, without any doubt. I would say across Australia nationally, probably very few banks not touched.
And what does this do to Westpac's reputation?
Not a lot, obviously.
But AUSTRAC has made it pretty clear in their statement of claim that by not having its eye on the ball, that they've left themselves at risk of being exposed to child exploitation rings. And obviously that's not something that a bank wants to have against its reputation.
I would say that the bank in itself has exposed its shareholders to significant reputational damage.
In its annual report, Westpac signalled there could be a significant financial penalty, but didn't want to go into the numbers. But clearly, the main guide we have is the Commonwealth Bank, $700 million.
Yes. I'd be surprised if it wasn't circa that, possibly more. I mean, it is considerably larger.
So is Brian Hartz's role as chief executive at Westpac in jeopardy?
I would say it's likely.
That he might have to leave.
Yeah, it is likely. If they want to clean the house and want to be seen to do the right thing and taking it seriously, the board are meant to be told of issues, so deniability is going to be a bit tricky.
That's Gavin Durbin, the executive director of the consultancy AML Solutions, speaking about those allegations against Westpac with Peter Ryan. The Australian hostage held captive by the Taliban for 3 years is now free. Timothy Weeks is still in Afghanistan undergoing health checks, but he will soon be home. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is thanking the United States government for its part in securing the Australian's release, which came as part of a prisoner swap. Political reporter Tom Eagledon has the latest.
Said to be in good spirits and described as in okay physical condition, 50-year-old Timothy Weeks' three-year ordeal as a hostage came to an end overnight. The Prime Minister Scott Morrison and his deputy Michael McCormack are both welcoming the news in their own way.
I couldn't be more thrilled. The Foreign Minister spoke to Tim's family, it was overnight I think, and they are just rapt and very grateful.
And given the fact that he has very close connections to Wagga Wagga, I'm delighted. As my hometown, yeah. I know all Wagga Wagga is celebrating today.
The Prime Minister says hard work by American officials paved the way for the breakthrough.
We thank very much the fantastic work that has been done by President Trump and the United States administration.
The Afghan government of President Ashraf Ghani is also a central player in the deal that saw the release of Timothy Weeks. Here's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne.
I know the Prime Minister is intending to speak to President Ghani later today and to convey Australia's thanks, and I look forward to seeing the time when we are able to welcome him back to Australia's shores.
When exactly that will be is not certain for now.
That's very much a matter for both medical advice if it's required, but also for Tim and his family.
Timothy Weeks had barely arrived in Afghanistan to take up a job as a teacher at the American University in Kabul in 2016 when he was snatched, along with an American colleague, Kevin King, who was also released overnight. In exchange, three members of the Taliban were freed from detention in Qatar. They include Anas Akhani, the younger brother of the Taliban's military chief, Hafiz Rashid, who's an important operational leader, and Haji Mali Khan, another senior commander.
These are quite significant figures in the Taliban, particularly the Haqqani network, which is the military, more violent wing of the Taliban.
Nirmatullah Ibrahimi is a senior research fellow at Alfred Deakin University, and he says the prisoner swap deal is an important moment for Ashraf Ghani's government as it looks to build confidence among its Western allies.
The Afghan government is in control of quite a significant number of Taliban prisoners, and any release of those prisoners would involve the Afghan government being supportive of any peace talks between the Americans and the Taliban.
So in a sense, this is the Afghan government dealing itself into the game as these talks continue between the US and the Taliban.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't know exactly if there is any formal talks happening now between the Taliban and the US, because there have been no confirmation of any direct meetings between US officials and the Taliban since September.
Is there some danger, in your view, in having these men released from detention?
Well, I think this decision hasn't been taken very lightly by the Afghan government, and I assume also the American officials who were also involved in these negotiations, because there have been evidences that, you know, previous prisoners have been released, they are just going back to the battlefield. But I understand that this time there have been some negotiations, probably there may be some conditions on their freedom. They may not be able to go back to Afghanistan as easily.
That's Nirmatullah Ibrahimi, a senior researcher at Deakin University. Tom Eagledon reporting. Well, it's now 18 years since the United States and its allies, including Australia, sent armed forces into Afghanistan to topple the Taliban, and the country is still at war. In just the last year, the conflict killed more than 900 children and severely damaged the mental health of many more. Today, the charity Save the Children has released a report that reveals the alarming levels of fear, anxiety, insomnia and self-harm among Afghan children. David Sparks reports.
In a small, sunlit classroom in Kabul province, a dozen children sitting on the floor relish the chance to practice reading. One of them is 10-year-old Hamat. I love my school, he says. I like my classroom because I have friends there. 8-year-old Ghazal feels the same. She says, when I get to school, I play with my classmates. We play football together. But these children face a psychological ordeal just trying to get from home to the classroom. On my way to school, I'm scared of kidnapping, suicide attacks and mines on the road, Ghazal says. And from Hamat, this. There is war in my country. People are killing children. The number of children dying in Afghanistan's conflict has risen sharply. In 2009, just over 300 children were killed. But by 2018, the figure had tripled to more than 900. Save the Children's country director in Afghanistan, Ono Van Manen, says the numbers will be no better this year.
We've seen an increase in fighting on the ground. We've also seen an increase in aerial bombardments. So overall, the conflict, unfortunately, has intensified over the last couple of years. When I travel to our field locations and I visit our child-friendly spaces or some of the community-based classrooms, you can actually see the war and the conflict on the faces of the children.
Save the Children's report, which is called Afraid to Go Outside, surveyed 600 parents and 90 children across four provinces. 62% of parents said their children have been affected by the conflict. 38% said their children had self-harmed.
It's all around them. Fighting happens in many locations. There's no way that you can avoid children from not only seeing that and hearing that when it happens, but also of seeing the impact of that.
Of particular concern is that parents and children say travelling to and from school is the most dangerous part of children's lives. Save the Children is calling for action to address problems identified in this report. It wants new initiatives to protect children on the way to and from school. It also says aid agencies and the Afghan government must scale up mental health and psychological support for children. 10-year-old Hamat just wants to help his country get better. I want to become a police officer and serve the country, he says. I want to end the war and protect people.
Afghan student Hamat there. David Sparks reporting. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Well, now to the mysterious case of a man imprisoned in the ACT last year in a process which was hidden from the public. It's understood that the prisoner, given the pseudonym Alan Johns, was a former government official, but details about his crime and background have been suppressed. The case is raising questions over whether more such secret trials are taking place in Australia. With more, here's Eleanor Whitehead.
Not much is known about the prisoner being called Alan Johns. His crime and the Commonwealth orders made about his case were so secret that even he wasn't fully aware of their details. Stephen Blanks is spokesperson for the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties.
Secrecy in cases like this is normally the hallmark of totalitarian regimes, not a free society.
The prisoner was jailed in Canberra in 2018 and released earlier this year. The secrecy surrounding his case seems to have been imposed on orders from the Commonwealth.
Well, I can't recall any other similar situation where not only the identity of the party and, of course, all of the witnesses and the evidence have been suppressed, but also the very existence of the trial appears to have been suppressed. That's very disturbing.
The case only came to light after a dispute between the prisoner and jail authorities made its way to the ACT Supreme Court. It centred around a memoir which he had penned about his experiences in jail. When he contacted an author, Robert Macklin, for help publishing it, the federal police raided the inmate's cell and his brother's home, and the prison froze his communications. Brian Toohey is author of a book on Australia's security state.
Nothing surprises me once we've had this absolute avalanche of new laws giving great powers to the security services to do this sort of thing. Even so, there is no possible excuse for having a trial in which you don't even tell the public that the court case has been held. You don't even tell what the charges are. You don't even say whether there was guilt or innocence. You don't even say that the person's been put in jail. It is just making a mockery of the idea that we are a traditional small-L liberal democracy.
Michael Shoebridge is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Defence Director. He says this case does nothing to stop what is a diminishing trust in Australia's public institutions.
There is a disturbing pattern in Australian government of not disclosing what can and should be disclosed to the public. You see that from the litany of censored and delayed freedom of information requests out of all different government departments, notably the Defence Organisation. And you see it in the fact that investigative journalists may now face criminal trials, which is an appalling situation in a democratic state. So if there were more of these secret trials without proper discussion of the principles and reasons for that being the case, then I think it would be a very disturbing pattern.
That's Michael Shoebridge, the director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Defence Strategy and National Security Program. Eleanor Whitehead reporting. Researchers from Monash University and Ambulance Victoria are today warning Australian governments that they need to change their approach to the opioid crisis. The research team trawled through almost 6 years of data on opioid-related ambulance call-outs and found that half the overdoses were not accidental, they were intentional. The researchers say the current official focus on preventing unintentional harm from opioids needs to shift urgently to suicide prevention. Isabel Rowe has more.
Newcastle woman Robin Lewis used to be a drug addict. These days she's clean and now works as a counsellor helping other addicts. But one of the most common drugs she sees in the community are those prescribed by a GP.
I mean, all you have to say is, oh, you know, that's not working anymore, and the doctor will give you a higher dose. People are going in there for a sore arm and they're coming out with a full-blown opioid addiction.
And Robin sees the toll opioids take on the community. Recently, one of her friends took his own life after years of addiction. She says while many addicts do reach out to helplines and rehab centres, they often can't respond in time.
People aren't getting the help they need when they need it. Yeah, it's a terrible situation to be in.
The use of opioids like codeine have been under scrutiny in recent years after revelations more Australians die from taking pharmaceutical opioids than the illicit drug heroin. In a comprehensive study, Monash University and Ambulance Victoria have analysed 14,000 opioid-related ambulance call-outs between 2013 and 2018. They found just 6% of people had accidentally taken too much, and half of the overdoses were likely suicide attempts. Associate Professor Suzanne Nielsen led the study.
One of the assumptions around opioid-related harm has been that most of it is accidental. I think what this paper really adds is that there are many cases of harm which seem like they're not necessarily accidental and that they're more complex.
The research found a third of overdoses where an ambulance was called involved the use of codeine and oxycodone, both prescribed for pain. When the study started, codeine was readily accessible over the counter, but it was made prescription only early last year. Associate Professor Nielsen says it's those more common opioids that are being used in excess.
Codeine is a weak opioid that's relatively widely available, and we saw this involved in two out of every five attendances, so it was very common. In contrast, we didn't see that many fentanyl-related attendances, but the ones that we did were very severe.
The study found younger people, including children as young as 12, are the most likely to intentionally overdose on the prescription drugs. Suzanne Nielsen wants the research to encourage policymakers and doctors to consider a patient's mental health before prescribing opioids. Dr. Hester Wilson is an addiction expert at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, and she agrees.
There are, you know, a percentage of people who have high levels of distress and are suicidal and are undertaking this behaviour as a way to manage their distress. And we need to help them to find ways that are less dangerous and are going to be more beneficial for them.
And do those services exist? And are they? Is there enough of them?
They do exist. I think they need to be further developed. Initially, it's going to be more expensive because you've got to put time and money into that. But it's going to actually improve people's lives and save lives.
The study has been published today in the journal Addiction.
Isabel Rowe reporting. The Packer family has dominated the Australian media for four generations, both running large parts of it and featuring in it. Now a new play is exploring the Packers and the myths surrounding them. National Arts reporter Michaela Bolan dropped into a rehearsal.
Dad, please, will you get me through this?
I doubt even I can do that, son.
You have excluded yourself from an important milestone. Packer is bringing television to Australia.
The Packers are a family dynasty that's dominated Australian business, sport and at times politics for the best part of a century. It was Frank Packer who grew the family empire beyond publishing when he acquired Channel 9 in the 1950s. But it was his son Kerry who left a $6.5 billion media empire when he died on Boxing Day 2005. The actor John Howard portrays both men in the new play Packer and Sons.
If you had to choose, which character do you prefer to portray, Frank Packer or Kerry Packer?
If I had to choose, I think Sir Frank, because people aren't so familiar with Sir Frank, and so I probably get to have more fun with him.
What's the greatest challenge in portraying Kerry?
I think the sense of entitlement. Kerry Packer, whatever you say about him, was extraordinarily resilient and determined.
For John Howard, the rivalries between the Packer men are complex.
This is a case of kings not wanting to relinquish the throne, and sons wanting to usurp the king. And so there are all kinds of complex jealousies and sometimes petty differences, sometimes very serious differences.
You're giving hot publicity at our expense. The ACTU has the entire nation at a standstill now, see?
No, actually, I think it's about something far more important.
Eamon Flack is the play's director. How did you settle on John Howard to play Kerry Packer?
John was my instant first and only thought. I've worked with John a couple of times. I think it's because John's fearless. Kerry learnt to be fearless and learnt to be kind of ugly, not to hide his ugliness. And John's got that quality as an actor. He's not afraid of human ugliness. And that's the key thing, I think, with Kerry.
Writer Tommy Murphy made his name with the theatrical adaptation of the trailblazing HIV autobiography, Holding the Man. He worked with living subjects in his follow-up play, Mark Colvin's Kidney.
This story, Packer and Sons, has always had the focus of fathers and sons and those moments of transition where the prince tries to take the crown.
James Packer has, you know, said that he has had mental health issues. What responsibility do you feel to him, given those admissions?
Packer and Sons doesn't deal with recent events. It finishes at about 2001, so it doesn't go into any of the recent public announcements that James Packer has made about his mental health. And on that, I believe James has been rightly praised for his leadership.
By ending the play in 2001 with the OneTel collapse, James Packer's disastrous attempt to make his mark in the business world, Tommy Murphy avoided the difficulty of working recent events into the story. James Packer's resignation as executive chairman of his casino empire and damaging revelations the gambling giant was skirting money laundering laws remain in the future for Packer and Sons.
It's not a satire. It doesn't take easy shots. It's not mean-spirited or trying to take anyone down a notch. I think it's deeper and darker and trying to give a full account of the humanity of these complex people.
It's unlikely those closest to Kerry and James Packer will see the play.
I would like to think that if James saw the play, he would believe that it is a story that is told with empathy, that is accurate, and digs deep into this person's successes and also his struggles.
That's the writer of Packer and Sons, Tommy Murphy. That report from the ABC's national arts reporter, Michaela Boland. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Caroline Winter and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So today is Trans Day of Remembrance, which means that vigils around the world, lists of trans people who've been killed this year, will be read aloud. Australia has one of the shortest lists in the world, which sounds like good news, but there's a lot more to this story.
Only two of the more than 3,000 globally recorded trans killings in the last decade happened in Australia. So is that a plausible figure? And if not, how do we find the rest of those names?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.